It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the future of coal as an energy source here in the United States.
First, we're taking a look at the package of heroin laws passed in Wisconsin. A few months ago, Governor Scott Walker signed several bills aimed at addressing the growing problem of heroin use in Wisconsin.
As part of a new series on heroin in Wisconsin, the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team polled experts about how these laws are working so far. Nick Penzenstadler is with us to share the results. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having us.
Well, still a problem. We've seen a couple of heroin overdose deaths as recently as this weekend, right?
That's right. We had two young people right here in the Fox Valley that are suspected to have died from overdoses just this weekend.
Well, the legislature, the governor, see this as a problem. We had this bundle of laws. Is it too early to start thinking about how they're working or how effective they are?
Well, that's what the Department of Justice would tell you, that, you know, they like time to maybe get some data on this, but some of them were billed as making some immediate changes and hopefully turning the tide against this. So we talked to prosecutors and police and some experts about which ones they think will have the most impact and which ones maybe were good for the headlines but won't change habits or the results.
Well, one of those potential immediate impact laws is the use of Narcan, a drug that emergency providers can use for someone having an overdose. What's been the reaction to that among the people you talked to?
Right. That was the top bill that was picked out as having the most immediate impact and the one that the responders and the prosecutors and the people involved in this think will have the most impact. That Narcan is the word for naloxone, the drug administered that really rapidly counteracts the effects of an overdose. And other narcotics like oxycodone and can bring people back to life instantly when they're on a call.
And you, I think, quoted an EMT giving a really positive response. This is one of their feel-good calls in a weird way.
Right, yeah. We talked to a Oshkosh firefighter. Those are firefighter paramedics, so they've already had this training, and they can go on calls if there's an overdose, and someone can be have no pulse, not be breathing, and within a few minutes back up talking to these responders. So it's really rewarding for them to be able to get there in time, get them breathing, and basically come back to life.
Also along the lines of emergency response, this immunity for 911 calls, so somebody now doesn't have to worry about being arrested for using heroin themselves if they're as they're calling 911 to report an overdose. Have we seen an impact of this so far?
Yeah, I think the trick with this one is getting the users to know about this law and to not be afraid to call 911. For a long time in Wisconsin, as in other states, if you were using with a friend and that friend overdosed, you could be prosecuted for calling for help, if you were using as well. So this doesn't protect you if you provided the heroin, like the Len Bias situation. If you're a user that's providing the heroin that ends up killing someone, you can still get in trouble. But right now, if you take a friend to a hospital or call 911 or take them to a firehouse, you can get some immunity.
So both of those are built towards saving lives in case of overdose. How about the laws geared toward more treatment for opiate addiction?
Yeah, there's two pieces that pump some more money into programming. But again, that's more on the treatment side. So if there is one criticism for these laws, there isn't a whole lot aimed at prevention as far as getting people into this. They addressed prescription drugs, but there's nothing on that front end prevention side that really stops the habit from starting.
Well, there was one encouraging drug disposal, the idea that if we have fewer prescriptions of, fewer prescription painkillers sitting around in people's medicine cabinets, that lowers the risk that somebody's going to get hold of those and abuse them and then get addicted in the first place. Are we seeing these programs going around the state? Are pharmacies taking these drugs back so they can be destroyed?
It doesn't seem like pharmacies are quite there yet. I know that's the aim of this. The idea of the new law was to expand and encourage communities to do it, both in police departments and whoever is willing to get involved. And you have to go through some training and get hooked up with the federal drug folks to dispose of the drugs properly. But the idea is to expand this and, yes, to eventually have your local CVS or Walgreens take any extra prescriptions and make sure they get taken to the right place.
And speaking of the pharmacy counter, one of the laws says if you want certain prescriptions related to opiates, ones that people are getting addicted to, you've got to show ID to pick up that prescription. You point out in the piece, a lot of pharmacies were already doing that.
Yeah, this was common practice around the state. So some folks see this as kind of duplicating and maybe just codifying. If you're in a smaller community, a small hometown pharmacy might not be following that practice. So it's good for those areas. But like here in Appleton, all the Walgreens were already doing this. So it won't make a big change in that regard.
Well, you mentioned, and I want to dig a little deeper, the idea that most of these things are treatment, overdose, not as much on the prevention side. It didn't seem like legislators were thinking these were the be-all and end-all, though. Is there talk out there of next steps?
Yes, I think we're already seeing, obviously we saw Brad Schimmel, the Attorney General candidate for the Republicans, come out yesterday and today around the state talking about his plan, and part of that is adding resources to existing programs to prevent people from getting addicted. But there are some other measures we're seeing other states take as far as stopping people from starting, even on that prescription side. There's efforts in other states like Kentucky to limit how much of a supply you get of a prescription, maybe only 48 hours or even a couple days supply, and then you have to come back and get it refilled to kind of prevent that abuse from starting.
You mentioned one of the candidates for attorney general at a forum. I mentioned this on the show the other day when asked the top, law enforcement or crime and punishment issue in Wisconsin at a recent forum. All four major party candidates said heroin. Mm-hmm. So people are taking this seriously, it seems like.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think we're on the upswing as far as our heroin overdose deaths per capita. We're still on the low end in the country, so it's maybe not as alarming as Appalachia or the Southwest. I mean, West Virginia has a rate that's much larger than ours, but it's definitely being treated as a top priority because there's such high profile cases that can spread so quickly and really impact the community because it hits so close to home.
You talked to a bunch of people on the front lines on this. What was the sense that you were getting from them that we are on the upswing? Things are going to get, in terms of the number of heroin deaths, that things are going to get worse before they get better? Or are they seeing maybe the tide turning a little?
Well, I think everyone realizes that it's a combination of new laws, harder prosecutions, but also that awareness piece. So obviously we saw the Department of Justice hammering away at their Fly Effect campaign to get the word out that, the state is serious about this and there's going to be serious ramifications. So I think there's kind of a hope and watching in these next couple months and maybe next year at this time, we'd have a pretty good idea of, are these laws having an effect to really putting the numbers down? That's the ultimate number that everyone cares about. The overdose deaths at 227 last year, if we can knock that down for 2013, I think that would be a signal that we're moving in the right direction.
And again, talking to people in the police community, prosecutors, emergency responders, were there things that were saying along the lines of, here's what we need, here's what needs to be the next step?
Well, I think everyone wants more money for their programs or piloting new things. I think there was a lot of support for pilot programs. Try them on a small scale. If you can do something in Winnebago County, expand it to the state and put some money into it. But I think everyone realized this was a good first step, even if some of the laws, just put into law what had already been done. It's a good first step.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks for checking in with us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Nick Penza-Sadler. He's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team.
President Obama announced yesterday plans to cut carbon emissions at the nation's existing power plants by 30% by the year 2030, his administration's latest attempt to tackle climate change.
Coal-fired facilities would be hardest hit because they emit more carbon than other power plants. And while 37% of the nation's electricity is still produced by coal, that number is expected to come down, especially with the rise of natural gas as a, at least at present, affordable alternative. So where does that leave coal in America's energy picture for the coming decades?
Here to talk with us about the current state of coal and what the future might hold for coal as an energy source is Michelle Nyhaus. She's a science and environmental journalist and wrote a recent piece for National Geographic called "Can Coal Ever Be Clean?" Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Michelle, is it fair to say that we've got a complex relationship with coal in this country right now?
Yeah, that's extremely fair to say. Not only we, but the rest of the world has a very complex relationship with coal. We have had gained wonderful things from it for many, many, many years, but we've also been complaining about it for almost as long as we've been pulling it out of the ground and burning it for heat and power.
Here in Wisconsin, we're 14th in the nation in coal consumption, pretty high in terms of national standards. Australia is way up there. Can you put our current coal usage into perspective?
Well, we get about 40% of our power from coal, a little under 40% now, especially with the boom in natural gas production, the domestic boom in natural gas production. And that's about in line with the rest of the world. The rest of the world gets about 40% of its power from coal, and coal also produces about 40% of the world's share of greenhouse gas emissions.
Does any other energy source right now have as big a slice of the pie as coal does?
No, it does not. Yeah, coal is the big one. It's the biggest source of our power in the U.S., and it's also, as I said, the biggest single source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, in terms of why we use so much coal on a global scale, is it just a numbers game? Coal is cheap.
Coal is cheap. Coal is accessible, and it's relatively easy to produce power from. Coal use is continuing to rise, especially in industrializing countries like China and India, where coal is the most plentiful and the cheapest domestic power source. For my work, I do a lot of traveling in places where people are not yet served by the grid, and it's easy to understand why people are drawn to this really cheap, accessible form of power. We in the industrialized world put up with the pollution for a long time before we started doing something about it, and it's pretty easy to see why people are willing to put up with a bit of soot and ash in the air to get the wonderful benefits of electricity.
Now, you've written about the soot and ash in the air and more of the health consequences, the environmental consequences of coal. What do we need to know about, you know, why coal has its consequences?
Well, we've done, again, we here in the industrialized world have done a pretty good job of cleaning up the very obvious pollution from coal. We no longer see the killing smogs like those that descended on a coal mining town in Pennsylvania in the 50s and on London many times over the years. We've done a pretty good job of cleaning that kind of pollution out of the air. But what we haven't done such a good job of is cleaning up the carbon pollution from power plants, and that's what the new EPA proposed rules are designed to tackle.
And in terms of getting that carbon out of the air, what do you think about these new proposed emissions standards?
Well, they're a start. They're the first serious national effort to cut carbon pollution from our largest source of carbon pollution. So they're a milestone in that way. That said, these rules alone are not nearly enough to stabilize the climate for the long term. Their most significant impact may be in inspiring innovation in carbon reduction technologies, both here in the U.S. and abroad, as other countries look to the U.S. and say, oh, okay, the U.S. finally is serious about doing something about carbon pollution.
So if the United States is successful in reducing emissions and moving forward, getting the states on board behind these caps, what will that mean for the political capital that the United States might have when it goes to the bargaining table, say, with other countries, say, in Paris next year?
Well, of course, that remains to be seen. I think we were already yesterday hearing a few murmurings from other countries saying, this is significant. We see what the U.S. is doing. We see that Obama is putting a lot of political capital behind this effort, and we're going to take it seriously. But of course, as I said, a lot remains to be seen. These rules almost certainly face huge political and legal battles.
We've been moving away from coal over the past decade or so. Some of this may be is because of the recession that the country went through, but still there is a coal reduction. What do you make of that? What's behind it?
It's mostly because of the natural gas boom in the U.S. We have suddenly been producing lots and lots of domestic natural gas, and that has allowed us to cut our coal consumption here in the U.S. I think sitting here in the U.S., it's easy to think of coal as a fuel of the past. You know, it's a dirty black fuel that comes out of the ground, maybe, you know, something that was used 100 years ago. But it's very much in you know, it's very much on the forefront or in the foreground in other countries. If you go to China, you can see clouds of black smoke in any major city. If you're there on the right day, you see clouds of black smoke caused by coal-fired power plants. It's obvious that coal use is integral to the economy, and it's growing.
And let's talk a little bit about developing nations, China among them, as you pointed out. Is it going to be a hard sell to ask them to pivot like this and to work on reducing these standards along with the United States?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's much of a pivot for China. They have been, in the past decade or so, China has, by all accounts, all of the people I spoke to for the National Geographic story that I wrote about coal, all the people who are familiar with what's going on inside the Chinese government said that China is increasingly serious about tackling carbon pollution that contributes to climate change. And they're especially serious about improving their air quality because despite China's reputation as a society where free speech is not encouraged, there is a very strong tradition of public complaint. And the Chinese government is hearing from their citizens about the air quality. So I think they have been hedging their bets, so to speak. They've been investing a lot in lower carbon technologies for coal plants. They've been building lots of efficient coal plants, and they've also been investing in renewables. And I think the fact that the U.S. is finally taking a step forward and getting serious about carbon emissions may convince them to be more explicit about their commitment to reducing carbon and make follow the U.S. in making a more serious commitment and setting some hard targets.
And any ideas, you know, if the United States is less than successful in getting these rules implemented, what will that provide a disincentive for China to follow suit?
We'll have to see. I would imagine so.
Now, you talked about the rise of natural gas, and that's been a competitor for coal in recent years. Where's that coming from?
Where natural gas is physically coming
where
from?
Where is the rise in natural gas coming from? Why are we seeing more of it now?
Well, hydraulic fracturing technology has become so much cheaper. It's improved so much in recent years. It's allowed us to get at gas in Pennsylvania, in New York State, in Texas, and in the Rocky Mountain West, Colorado and Wyoming. It's allowed us to get at gas deposits that we previously thought were either inaccessible or just too expensive to get to. So it's a technology improvement that's opened up those deposits for us.
And in terms of some of the costs associated with natural gas, what do we know about that? The fracking, of course, has its critics, but is it in terms of coal's cost benefit ratio? How does it compare to natural gas?
Well, the jury is still out on that. I mean, there's research being done right now on the amount of methane that is released when natural gas is pulled out of the ground. And methane is a very intense greenhouse gas. It causes much more damage to the climate than carbon dioxide does. And so if there's a certain level of methane releases from natural gas, any carbon benefits that you could get from burning natural gas might just be a wash. So we really... hopefully the boom in natural gas has had the secondary consequence of reducing the nation's carbon footprint, but we're really not sure about that yet.
So the jury's still out, sounds like.
Yes, yes.
Well, in the reaction to the new EPA standards, one concern is that they could drive coal plants out of business. They could cause lost jobs in coal-producing regions that depend on those jobs. Does that make coal harder to regulate?
Well, there are certainly, you know, I lived for many, many years in a coal mining town, and I have every sympathy for individual people who are going to be laid off or will find themselves without a job for any number of reasons. That said, we've been in this position before. We have, in the 1990s, when we got serious about dealing with acid rain and with controlling the acid rain precursors that we were putting out of coal plants, the coal industry said, these regulations are going to kill the economy, they're going to kill jobs. And what happened was that once those regulations went into place and the industry had some certainty, there was an explosion of innovation and experimentation that made those technologies much cheaper. I don't want to pretend that these changes are free, come without cost. Certainly there will be some cost borne by some people, but I think given that experience, given our experience with acid rain, I think it can be done a lot cheaper than people are predicting that it can be done.
We're talking with science writer Michelle Niehaus about the future of coal as a power source in America in light of new regulations on carbon emissions announced yesterday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see a big shift away from coal in this country, or do you think we need to rely on it for our electricity production? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're talking about the future of coal in the United States after President Obama announced yesterday that he's looking to slash carbon emissions from existing power plants 30% by the year 2030.
Science writer Michelle Niehaus stays with us, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Going forward, how big a part should coal play in our energy mix? What alternatives would you like to see if natural gas fracking turns out to be have less of an impact than coal production? Would you like to switch to that? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We have Jeff on the line from Bayfield. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What do you think?
What I think is that, as your previous calls mentioned, there is no free energy. And I will freely admit, you know, coal apparently is wildly polluting. My understanding is that it emits more radiation than a lot of the new plants. The point is, we have more coal in this country, as I understand it, than they have oil in the Middle East. I don't understand why more effort isn't being put into cleaning up the coal. We've got it. It's high energy fuel. There's got to be some way to use it in an environmentally reasonable way, as opposed to simply discarding it. It's too polluting. We can't use it. The reality is we need the energy, and I just don't understand why more effort isn't being put into economical ways to clean this up such that we can make this a viable energy source.
Great. Thanks so much for your call, Jeff. And that's a great point to bring up. And I know this is something that you've talked about, Michelle, the prospect of clean coal, whether such a thing is viable, and getting into the future or present of carbon capture.
Yeah, it's a great point. And there has been a surprising, at least to me, surprising amount of research done on producing power from coal while reducing the carbon emissions that are produced in that process. The U.S. government has funded research for 20 years. Industry has contributed to that research. The problem is that the technologies that we have, the technologies we understand the best, which are called carbon capture and storage technologies, and that's a basket term for a whole lot of different things, but basically we're talking about pulling the carbon dioxide out of the other products that are produced when you burn coal, compressing that gas and storing it underground indefinitely. The trouble with those technologies is that they, at least for the foreseeable future, are always going to add to the cost of the power produced. So no coal company in its right mind is going to voluntarily install them. And because we've been allowing coal plants to more or less dump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for free, continuing with business as usual makes the most financial sense to them. So that's one reason why these regulations are so important, and why I mentioned that they have the potential to jumpstart some innovation in the so-called clean coal field. Once coal companies and electric utilities have a reason, have a financial incentive to capture and store the carbon that they're now emitting for free, I think we are going to see those technologies get cheaper, get more efficient, and get easier to install.
Michelle, so if this the carbon is captured and it is put underground, how big a process is that? What kind of technology are we talking about?
Well, it's a big process and it's expensive. I visited a couple of pilot facilities, and the capture part of the process, which is, of course, just the first step. You capture the carbon, you compress it, and then you store it. Just the capture facilities for these pilot programs are huge. Some of them are the size of apartment buildings. So this is not a casual undertaking. And as I said, it's not something that any coal company is going to volunteer for. But progress on this research has been held up by the lack of incentive, as I said. So we've been stuck in a bit of a vicious cycle where all the scientists I spoke to said, we know a lot about these technologies, but what we really need is some commercial scale tests. And there's no reason for any industry to sign up for a commercial scale test. Now there's a reason. If these proposed regulations go forward, companies will have a reason to sign up for those tests, and I think we'll see the technology improve.
And yet it wasn't something we heard about from the EPA. So this is just the prod, I guess, and then the technology may follow.
We didn't hear specifically about carbon capture and storage.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they did mention cap and trade systems where you could trade companies that emit carbon dioxide could trade pollution credits with other companies. And that would be one place where a company would have an incentive to install a carbon and capture system and then trade those pollution credits with another company and benefit financially that way. So they weren't mentioned explicitly, but they are one tool that's available to companies. And we'll find out. You know, they'll be competing with other technologies such as increasing efficiency, decreasing customer demand, and we will find out if these technologies that scientists have been working on for so long are able to compete in the marketplace.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Jeff. And we're going to go next to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
My comment is the issue that we have with going to some of the lower emission power sources is really you need a backbone. Our coal plants are the backbone to our power grid, where they're able to ramp up when needed and ramp down and kind of follow what the pull is on the system, where solar doesn't really have that capability other than the new plant that was built by Abengoa Energy down in Gila Bend, Arizona, where they heat up water and they're able to store it and make electricity at night or cloudy days or things like that. But other forms of solar and other forms of wind have ups and downs on the way they produce electricity, where you have coal and or nuclear are really would be the backbone. And unfortunately, nuclear plants, other than a couple that are being built down in the southeast, have been really stopped, especially since the disaster in Japan. And we either have to open up to nuclear or really build an awful lot of solar plants, because we just can't do it with what we got right now.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. Got you there. And Michelle, what about that? Do we have an emerging energy source that could take the place of coal? And we're talking about nuclear a little bit there with Tom.
Well, it's a good point. And it's true that any power grid needs what's called a baseload source of energy. And coal is our baseload source of energy, coal with a little bit of nuclear. And that's why I think people who are concerned about climate change tend to think, oh, well, coal has all these problems. Let's just ditch it and replace it with solar and wind. In many ways, certainly from a climate change perspective, that would be great. But it's simply not possible. Just given the physical limits of the electrical grid, it's not possible. And that's one of the reasons why I do think we have to look into reducing the carbon footprint of coal power. We do have to look into improving the efficiency and the price point of some of these capture and storage technologies, because the climate problem is big. It's getting bigger, and we are running out of time to hold off the worst effects of climate change. And so I think we need to make big reductions now, and we can't wait for solar and wind to become feasible at enormous scales before we do that.
Let's try to get one more quick caller in. We've got Jerry on the line from La Crosse. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Yeah, I'm concerned with the big picture, and I'm kind of pessimistic. If you take, say, some country in the developed world that you, speaker, that you consider really doing a good job of handling CO2 emissions, and ask how much per person, how much carbon they emit per person. And then it assumes the rest of the world, and we know the rest of the world wants to be as rich as they are. And we really can't say, no, you can't be as rich as they. Will we be accomplishing our objective if they all would say meet the emissions of, say, Holland or whoever you consider doing a good job? Or how much do we have to reduce per person carbon emissions? Do we look forward to a time when the USA has to reduce our standard of living to, say, northern India or something?
All right. Thank you for that call, Jerry. And what about role models and looking at what other countries, developing countries around the world, are going to have to do to keep pace?
Well, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the question is about how much we're going to have to change our lifestyle in order to solve the problem of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, we're at the point now with climate change where we're choosing between bad climate change and worse climate change. I mean, there is no avoiding climate change. We're already seeing the effects of it. And I think, now we are working to reduce our carbon footprint as much as possible. And I think there are a lot of numbers being thrown around, but we don't know what a sustainable global carbon footprint will look like because we don't know what kind of technological innovations lie ahead. And I think one of the reasons why I and many others think these regulations are so important is that they are a signal from the U.S., one of the world's largest carbon emitters, that this is a serious problem. We are going to take some political risk and take some financial risk to do something about it. And I think hope lies in some big step changes in our knowledge of how to deal with the problem.
We're going to have to leave it there. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
We've been speaking with journalist Michelle Nyhaus. She joined us to talk about the future of coal as an energy source in America.
From tornadoes to flooding and electrical blackouts, summer weather is notorious for bringing a host of unexpected emergencies. For today's Teach Me What You Know, we're joined by Ken Collier, the editor-in-chief at The Family Handyman. He's here to talk about some simple ways to prepare for the challenges the warmer season can throw at us. Ken, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you, Rob.
Well, we've had some heavy rains in parts of Wisconsin lately, so let's start with basement flooding. Say we see our basement is flooded. What's the first thing to do and maybe to not do?
Well, there's a couple things to keep in mind. The first is that you should treat water in the basement as poisonous. You never know what kind of chemicals might be mixed with it. It's pretty common for sewage water to come up through your floor drain. So that water, though it may look fine, could actually be pretty nasty stuff. So rubber boots, rubber gloves, even goggles are not a bad idea. The second thing is that you really should treat it as electrically charged until you know otherwise. It's pretty common for there to be some kind of electric current in the water from a power cord that was on the floor or something like that. So before you go wading around in the water, be sure to turn the power off to the basement. Unfortunately, lots of times the electrical panel is on the other side of the basement. In that case, it's best to call your power company, and they can shut off the power to your house at the pole or at the street, and then you can go about getting the water out.
And I've seen in places that have had higher flooding, another risk is putting out pilot lights on furnaces.
Yes, you want to be very careful about how you turn appliances back on. Often people are not aware that that appliance like a water heater might have a pilot light. So this is something where you can get help from your gas company or a plumber to show you how to make sure they're all lit properly.
And Ken, you mentioned the rubber boots, the rubber gloves, the goggles. Let's talk about just having a prepared household, a prepared kit. What kind of things are vital for us to have on hand in case of the various emergencies we're going to talk about?
Well, you know, people can get pretty serious about getting ready for getting ready for a problem. And depending on where you live, you might be ready to be without power for a day, a couple days, and even beyond that. But one of the basic things that has really gotten a lot better in the last few years is just having a flashlight you can rely on. Modern LED flashlights will burn for a long time without using up their batteries. And if you outfit your flashlight with lithium batteries, they're a little more expensive, but they have a shelf life of as much as 10 years. So it can sit in your kitchen drawer or wherever, and you can count on it being good to go when the power goes off.
It's no fun to find that one with the rusty, corroded battery
that has no hope of working.
And I think we've all been there probably at some point.
Yep.
Well, you mentioned being ready for that power outage. Let's get to that next. The power's out. We maybe make a call to the utility company. What else should we do?
Well, there's a couple interesting things. Most people are not aware that their appliances have computers in them. Most modern dishwashers, refrigerators, even washers and dryers can have computers in them. And the computers are not particularly well protected from power surges. So if the power goes out, one of the things you want to watch out for is the big surge that can happen when the power goes back on. It comes, first of all, from the power company itself turning the power on, but secondly, because things like your refrigerator and your air conditioner instantly turn on. And so those motors are causing even more of a surge. So it's not a bad idea, especially if you live in a place where power outages are frequent, to disconnect the appliance when the power goes off, and then wait until the power's gone on, until your refrigerator's gone on and your air conditioner, before you, for example, reconnect the dishwasher and the washer-dryer. I had this happen to me. I had this very nice, quiet, German-made dishwasher, not protected, and when the computer went out, it was $800 to replace it.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's like saying buy a new dishwasher.
I think of computers, those I always unplug even during an electrical storm when the power's out, too. I don't think of all those other things that have the computers in them.
Yeah, it's kind of sneaky. You know, that stove you've got that's got the little touchpad on it and that has a timer and all that actually has a little computer in it. And when that goes, it's a very expensive part, a couple hundred dollars.
Well, moving on to the tornado. I think a lot of us in Wisconsin kind of know the tornado drill, but what are some key points and, again, some things not to do?
Well, one of the main things is just to stay away from glass and anything that could be falling from above. So Wisconsin's basement country, so basements are obviously the place to go. And if there's anything above you that gives you some protection from, you know, for example, if the roof caved in, so much the better. People sometimes will get under a heavy table, for example. And if you're working in a kind of job where you have a hard hat, well, it's good to have hard hats around the house, too. So.
And we hear sometimes, open up the windows, equalize the pressure. Old wives' tale?
No, those don't really do anything. In fact, kind of surprisingly, garage doors are one of the weakest parts of your house when it comes to a tornado. Lots of times they're the place where the tornado will get, it'll blow in the garage door, lift the garage roof off, and then can start to peel away your house. Mm. So opening the windows doesn't do much.
Don't go around opening up windows when a tornado is on the way.
Yeah, it's just going to get the floor wet.
Now, I was looking on your website. You cover a lot of other things. One thing that I hadn't thought about much, I've had some creatures in houses. You give some raccoon preparedness tips. What do we do if we found a raccoon rummaging around in the kitchen?
Well, you know, that one's more of a don't than anything else. Some people think that they're going to get their dog to help them, and that's a real no-no. The dog will come away bitten, and you'll just spend lots more in veterinary bills than it would cost to get rid of the raccoon. So the thing to do is call your animal control officer, or if you're way out in the country, I have a heart trap will also work.
And how about bats? I know we're about a month and a half away or so from when the baby bats will start being born and getting out and about, and they often find their way into people's living space.
Well, again, boy, I shouldn't tell you the one that my grandmother always had me do, but I will anyway, because she had bats in her house. And that was to use a tennis racket and then throw them outside. So, but the main thing is to keep them out of the house. You know, once they're in, they're hard to capture. But the thing to do is to just seal the space where they're getting in. Because usually if a bat can get in, you're losing your heat there. You're going to have a problem with insects. So it's just a good thing to know is to seal up the cracks wherever they can get in.
Oh, one more I wanted to mention. This could be an anytime thing. We mentioned the rain floods. What about those big geysers we get in our plumbing sometime? What do we need to know about our plumbing system to take quick action when something springs a big leak?
Are you mean like what to do in case there's a water spraying from the kitchen?
Exactly. You got it. Yeah.
Well, it's one of the basic things that everybody who lives in the home should know, and that is where the main water shutoff valve is. Every house will have one. And yet often it's something that only the resident handy person knows, if that. But if there's any kind of water emergency where water's flowing and you can't stop it, the thing to do is go down, it's typically in the basement, and shut off the main water valve.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Rob.
And there's some homework for homeowners out there. When the show's over, go find that main shutoff valve. That's Ken Collier. He's editor-in-chief at The Family Handyman. Been talking about how to prepare for summer emergencies in this installment of Teaching Me What You Know. Each week at this time, we learn how to do something new. Next week, how to have a successful garage sale.